You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. In November, Portlanders will have a new election method before them to help decide the composition of the new city council. It's ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting was part of a suite of changes in the charter reform that was passed in 2022. Ranked choice voting represents a pretty big shift from how voters are filling out their ballots normally, so we're here to learn some more about it. I spoke with Grace Ramsey with Democracy Rising. She's a national expert in ranked choice voting, and we're going to go more into what RCV is all about. Welcome to the show, Grace.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here.
I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Let's start with a little bit of primer here, since, you know, this is a new issue for a lot of our listeners. What is ranked choice voting?
Yeah, so ranked choice voting, it's kind of in the name. So voters rank their choices, right? But let's think of how kind of a typical election that we think of works. You look at the list of candidates, you either pick your favorite or pick the one that you like but has the best chance of winning. You fill in that bubble, that's it, right? And you just really hope that they do well. With ranked choice voting, it's a little bit more involved than that, right? We get to ask voters their preferences in a more profound way, or a more nuanced way, I guess. And so instead of just picking that one candidate and hoping they do well, voters get to rank their choices. You get to pick that favorite candidate that you have, but you also get to think, okay, so if that candidate doesn't have enough support to be in the running, who's my backup choice, right? So you have those choices that you can rank for those candidates.
Well, I know that you have helped implement ranked choice voting in different cities and states around the country. How do those different systems differ from each other? As in, how many are you allowed to rank, or how does that kind of thing shake out?
You know, you don't want to necessarily say every city is a snowflake, but they kind of are. Every state, every city has different ways of doing things. So it's varied a lot from different places. The nice thing is, for voters, the process is essentially the same. You pick your favorite candidate, mark them as your first choice, pick your next favorite candidate, mark them as your second choice, and so on. But let's see. So I got my start in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where they use ranked choice voting, but they only use it for one person at a time. So that's a slight difference, right? So here, the way Portlanders are going to use ranked choice voting to elect mayor and auditor, that would be across the board in Minneapolis. Whereas here, you all are electing three council members from each of the four geographic districts. So I'm biased in both directions, right? Of Minneapolis is where I learned about this and really feels like kind of where I became aware of that we could do democracy differently. Whereas I think the system that Portland is implementing is really cool, and I'm really excited about it.
So, right, you rank your choices, mm-hmm. and it's exciting because it's more expansive than two, or sort of, you know, bargaining with who is most likely to win that most matches me, right? What happens to those votes after they're cast?
Sure. So it works a little differently depending on which elections we're talking about. So let's start by just talking about if we are electing mayor or auditor, where we only have one person. So the way that you win in a ranked choice voting election when you're just electing one person is you need to earn more than half of the votes, because only one person can do that, right? If two people have more than half, something has gone wrong. And so what we do is we start by only looking at voters' first choices. Those backup choices on your ballot, we're not looking at them at all. And if somebody has more than half of the votes, they win. We're done. But the part about ranked choice voting that's very cool, and let's also think about that in like larger election contexts, right? There are a ton of elections that we have where when we look at voters' choices, nobody has more than half of the votes, right? And so whoever has the most wins, and then we're done. And that could mean a lot of people aren't represented in that election or in who's going to be in office. So with ranked choice voting, we take it a step further. If no one has more than half of the votes, we eliminate the candidate with the least amount of support. And so that candidate, you know, probably gave it a great effort, but for one reason or another, just wasn't really pulling a lot of support from the community. We eliminate that candidate, and the voters who ranked that candidate as that first choice would have their vote instantly go to their next choice. And then we repeat, where we look and see if anybody has more than half of the votes. If not, we eliminate the next candidate with the fewest votes, and the same process happens, and we keep going until we have someone win with more than half of the votes, until somebody passes that sort of finish line. And that way we build consensus within the electorate. And for city council, it works the exact same way for voters, but a little bit differently in terms of how the votes are counted. So just like we said, only one person can get more than half of the votes when we're just electing one person, like mayor or auditor. If we're electing more than one person, the number of votes somebody needs to win changes. So for instance, with Portland, each district will be electing 3 members of the city council. And so the question becomes, how many votes can 3 candidates all get that 4 can't? And that number is 25%, a quarter of the votes. Because if 4 people have more than a quarter of the vote, something has gone wrong, right? We have too many votes accounted for. So 25%, or just over 25%, is the number of votes people need to win. And so we start the exact same way. Voters rank those candidates in order of choice, and we only look at first choices when we start. If 3 candidates have more than 25% of the vote, we're done. Everybody's elected. If they don't, then we go into that process again, right? And the slight difference with the city council races that I think is really, it's just where this gets so cool, in my opinion, as an elections nerd a little bit, but also as somebody who wishes I had something like this where I live. So if a candidate has a ton of votes, more than they need to be elected, we don't want to punish a lot of voters for feeling the same way. If you're electing 3 seats and there's a huge group of you that feel really similar about a candidate's platform or the issues that are running this election, if there's a huge, huge group of you, we don't want to limit you to one of those seats. If maybe your strength in the electorate probably entitles you to more than one of those seats, right? And so what happens is if a candidate gets way more votes than they need, each of those voters would have a small portion, a tiny little portion, each of those voters go to their next choice on the ballot. So that is why this is a proportional system. That's why you've heard that, is that voters are getting their share of representation in proportion to their strength in the electorate. So if a candidate overperforms, again, each of those voters gets a little bit of their vote to go to their next choice. The way I think about it is my vote is a dollar. And let's say a candidate is so popular, they only needed 90 cents of my dollar to get elected. And so in a ranked choice system like this, I get to spend my 10 cents that's left over on another candidate. It's not my whole vote, but it's a little bit of my vote because that candidate just didn't need all of it. So we do that. And then we check, you know, do we have all of our seats filled? And if not, we repeat that process of eliminating the candidate with the fewest votes. Those voters instantly have their vote go to their next choice. And then we keep that process going until we have our 3 seats.
Thank you for explaining that. I've heard some criticism or maybe confusion recently about how it becomes proportional, right? Mm-hmm. And concerns that, you know, only 25% of a district is able to put a person on city council.
Can
yeah,
I jump
please.
In there? I would challenge to think of that from the other perspective. 75% of voters in those districts will have a say in who represents them, right? If 3 candidates are getting 25% of the vote, 75% of voters get a say. And so it is different, right? Having that level be different. But also, let's think about other races that we've seen in our normal elections where there's tons of candidates and somebody can win with 14%, right? So every election has its things, right? Like our status quo, you may not be surprised, I don't always love in a lot of situations because I don't think it always supports the breadth of choice that voters are looking for. And so this system answers for that and makes sure that we're representing people in proportion to their strength in the electorate.
I'm interested in your perspective on, you know, this being adopted in other places. Have you noticed common themes about how it's received?
Yeah. I think you said before that there are concerns, and I want to stress that, like, change is difficult, and people being concerned for their community is a good thing. Right? Like, people saying, like, hey, I want to make sure that we do this right, and I want to make sure that people get this. I think that's great. And for people who feel that way, I am hoping that they engage in voter education in this cycle. I hope they talk with folks and their neighbors and make sure that they're ready to go. I think change is difficult on every level whenever you change something, right? If there's a big new program being rolled out at the city level, if there's new services available to folks, there's always work that needs to be done to make that happen. And so what I've found is across the country, people are really invested in that work, however it gets done. And so that's what I do. And I've always been really excited to do so. And it's really fulfilling. But I think that's what we sense is there's some people who are really excited for something new. And then there are some people who are saying, okay, cool, you said all of these things are great. Let's see how this goes. And that's where I love when we have, you know, voter education efforts in these places, because we get to take those folks, say, what are your concerns? We want to hear you out. We want to make sure that we are aware of what's going on, but also like join us. Let's go talk to people about it. Let's go make sure that we're getting ahead of anything that's concerning folks. And I think over the years, you know, I've been educating voters about ranked choice voting specifically for 10 years now. I can understand how for some folks nationally, there's a real sense of frustration. But my 10 years of doing this has given me real faith in voters, and that when given the opportunity, they step up to the plate. The energy that I get from folks in doing this work is pretty amazing. And even when there are concerns, those are often the people that I'm most excited to work with, because it makes us better.
And I think that there's like a balance to strike there, right? Because some of the concerns sometimes sound like voters are too stupid to be able to figure out what they really want. And certainly there's this voter education piece to explain, hey, here's how to, for your fullest potential, for your fullest democratic participation, here's how to do X, Y, and Z, versus assuming too little of people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I as a rule, never underestimate voters. I mean, I think, and at the same time, give people the resources to empower themselves, right? So what we've found over the years is when a voter sees a ballot, it tends to be intuitive. That's not necessarily all the time. We all have, you know, there's so many different learning styles. There's so many different things. So we want to be attentive to that in how we educate voters. But one thing that I think gets looked over sometimes when I hear that folks are concerned about voters not getting it, is this thought process is actually one we use all the time. The example I like to give is I have a nephew who's in high school, and in a couple of years, he's going to have to start making some choices about what comes after high school. And he's going to have to think of his options, his candidates, if you will. So it could be a 4-year program. It could be a 2-year program. It could be an apprenticeship. It could be taking a year off. Yeah, right. You know, there's all these options in front of him. And what he's going to need to do is decide, what's my optimal choice? What is the thing I really, really want to do? Now, what if maybe a test score doesn't get me there? What if something goes wrong and that can't be what I do? What's my backup choice, right? If I can't have that perfect. And like, that is a real life, tough, impactful decision. And realistically, that is ranked choice thinking in action. And so I think often what my job is to take it out of politics so that folks know that they think this way regularly enough to put it back in.
Well, we just had our primary election in Oregon, no ranked choice voting on that ballot, at least in Multnomah County. For voters next fall, are there different things they'll need to prepare in order to vote with full information?
I think so. It's knowing what's on your ballot, right? And that's any election, any time, regardless of the system being used, is hopefully knowing what races are on there and what you need to have an opinion on as a voter, right? So we know that there's a presidential election. We know that there are federal elections and all of those. And when we get to city elections, the main thing to know is it's going to look a little different on your ballot, right? Instead of just filling in that one bubble, you're going to be able to fill in that one bubble for your first choice, your one bubble for your second choice, and so on. So I've seen a lot of elections where voters have, you know, the old way of doing elections and ranked choice voting on the same ballot, and they do just fine. But I think for voters, it's really in those races, you have this opportunity to really weigh your options in a different way, right? So instead of adding in the layer of, okay, I have these choices, who do I really like? Who has a chance of winning? You kind of get to eliminate that who has a chance of winning and really just focus on those choices in city elections. I can't guarantee that up and down the ballot, but that is up to the voters. And maybe they're, you know, maybe you're super excited, however it may be, but in those city elections, that layer is going to be removed and you get to really look at the field of candidates, decide who aligns with your values and your priorities and rank them in order.
Well, if our listeners are interested in learning more about ranked choice voting, maybe generally, but also, of course, in the Portland context, are there resources that you'd recommend?
So if voters are looking for more information, they can go to www.portland.gov/vote.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to hopefully connect with as many Portlanders about the election as possible in the coming months. So I'm glad to start here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. That was Grace Ramsey from Democracy Rising. She's a national expert in ranked choice voting, and we spoke about this new election method that Portlanders will be taking on in the fall. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We have Jeremiah Hayden, Street Roots reporter, and he will be discussing with us a local story published in Street Roots for the week of July 17th to the 23rd. How are you, Jeremiah?
Yeah, hi, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me. And Jeremiah, I use he, him pronouns.
So today we're going to talk about the ideological rifts that we're experiencing during our current homelessness crisis. So what about if we start by you talking to us about the new anti-public sleep ordinance that is now in effect in Portland?
Yeah, so the city of Portland passed this new ordinance in early May. They've done this, you know, repeatedly over the years, different things. They'll call them sit-lie ordinances, you know, a decade ago. Essentially just trying to move people who don't have an option for a place to sleep off of public rights away and in public spaces. So the latest one was passed in early May. And it technically went into effect July 1st. They were going to start enforcing that and actually threatening to fine people $100 or up to 7 days in jail if they refuse shelter when they're offered shelter. So there are a lot of reasons that a person who is experiencing homelessness might decline to go to a shelter. There's a lot of it isn't trauma informed to say a person is given a real option. You know, any option for shelter is reasonable because for a lot of people, you know, they've experienced different types of violence maybe in a shelter. They're not comfortable being in there. The reason that they're sleeping in a encampment with other people is because they've found community there that helps, you know, protect them from the real types of violence that people face when they're on the streets. So the city said they were going to start doing this on July 1st. And I think because of the heat, Portland Police Bureau has said that they actually haven't arrested anyone under that ordinance. There's still some open questions to whether or not they're approaching people and then arresting them maybe for other reasons. But yeah, so it gets a little bit hard to determine what is really happening exactly.
Yeah, it's complicated. And what about this agreement between City Council to respond to homelessness in Multnomah County? This is the HRAP, correct? Homeless Response Action Plan. What are your thoughts on this initiative?
That's right. Yeah, so we did a story in Street Roots a few weeks ago that published as Multnomah County had passed their part of this agreement. The city and the county have to reach an agreement every few years on how they're going to respond to homelessness. And then they each kind of have their own, you know, ordinances that need to be passed to start to enact those things that govern it. So there's a lot of wonky policy stuff, but generally they passed this plan. It's a really ambitious plan as far as the goals of it. It sets a pretty lofty set of goals, including sheltering or housing nearly 2,700 people, adding 1,000 new shelter beds onto the into the shelter continuum in Portland, and then goes as far as saying that it will end all behavioral health and hospital discharges to the street by the end of 2025. So some pretty broad-reaching goals. There are some criticisms about this plan, particularly from a few people at the county. Commissioner Sharon Myron actually voted against it, and then and then when it went to the city, Commissioner Mapps and Commissioner Ryan both voted against this plan. So some of those issues, you know, there's a lot of politicking that's happening here. So it people will bring, you know, the commissioners will kind of bring up different issues that they have with this, and it can be a little bit difficult to tell sometimes. You know, Renee Gonzalez has had it out for the county's harm reduction tools, like distributing tents and tarps to people who need shelter. You know, we're in the middle of a heat dome. Climate change is exacerbating, you know, the issues that people face. And they need these things. You know, it's life-saving, a place for people to keep things that keep them cool, the shade that a tarp can provide. They literally have nowhere else to go. Renee Gonzalez has kind of maintained this sort of pet project to take those away. And that's something that he introduced into this, trying to sort of get the county to agree to stop purchasing tents and tarps and eventually stop distributing them altogether. So there's, but still in effect, the county has these materials still. They're not buying more, but they still have some on hand at their warehouse, and they'll still make it into the community, and they'll still continue to save people's lives for as long as they still have those tools.
And do you know the reasoning by any chance of why Renee Gonzalez is kind of doing whatever he can to change what it's been done, like typically culturally here in Portland, helping the homeless, houseless community?
Right. He, you know, I can't really speak to his motivations too much, but, and he doesn't respond to our emails. But he, you know, there's kind of a split here right now. This is all sort of in light of the Supreme Court decision of Grants Pass v. Johnson that said that it's okay to punish people for being homeless, and even when they have nowhere else to go. And, you know, I reported on that, and one of the things that I really found is there's kind of a split between people who think that to make people who are homeless more miserable will somehow cause them to want to seek some sort of help. It's sort of a disingenuous kind of myth. People who are homeless, the vast majority of them want to live inside houses. It's much safer. They would like to get housing. Rents have risen 39%, you know, in 2021, 2022. So people can't afford it, and that's why they're not being housed. It's not a matter of not kind of reaching rock bottom, seems to, you know, hitting rock bottom and then seeking help seems to be one kind of way of going about this. And that seems to be kind of the Renee Gonzalez perspective on it. The other one, of course, is to recognize this as systemic political failures on the part of elected officials like Renee Gonzalez, you know, and Mayor Wheeler, you know, and again, at the county as well. Those failures to actually address the thing that resolves the housing crisis, which is housing, you know, those focusing on that would actually solve this problem, not creating more misery for people.
Yeah. And, you know, on that note, I've had people that have been homeless before. I've had them tell me that one of the reasons why they choose to, or they've chosen to camp instead of going to a shelter, is because of all the rules at the shelter. Like, it feels unsafer or less safe to be in a shelter for many than to just be free outside. And like you said before, like in community. What do you think about this? Because I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people that experience houselessness.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of complicated responses to that question. I think that, you know, Portland State University, the Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative, has done a lot of research over the years in, you know, different kind of shelter models. And sometimes, you know, one of the most important things to keep people, one of the things that helps people remain safe, you know, is to be in a community with people that they trust. And those kinds of things are often taken away in shelter systems. And to the extent that these things interact, and I want to be clear that drug addiction is not largely the thing that leads to people becoming homeless. People usually end up with drug addiction issues after they've become homeless as a means to coping with their homelessness. Of course, once people are homeless, the drug addiction stuff, it can be exacerbated. It can be, it's a bi-directional thing. It sort of continues to, you know, each thing makes the other thing worse. The kinds of rules around that within some shelters can make people unable to go there. Some people have medications that they take for previous injuries that they can no longer have in those shelters. And so that isn't really a viable option for someone. That can be, you hear a lot of people talking about, you know, behavioral health issues that you see kind of out in the streets and stuff. And to an extent that can be because people can't access, you know, the medications that they need and stuff. So there's a big systemic problem. And this, you know, again, this homelessness response plan that the city and county passed at face value looks to address some of these things. It brings in a lot more understanding about those complications for people that people experience. The question is whether or not it can be implemented in a way that really makes a difference is still kind of an open question.
Yeah, too many people that have to make decisions on behalf of a large segment of our population here.
And often not asking those people what it is that they need either.
Exactly, yeah, making decisions based on their perspective, which is completely different from the perspective of a person experiencing homelessness.
Right, absolutely.
So on that note, can you clarify the difference between, or the difference in regards to the involvement that the city has in comparison to the county when it comes to dealing with this issue?
Yeah, that's one of the things that some people took issue with. Commissioner Myron asked questions over and over again of the other people, the other board members on the county board, and of the people who helped to develop the homelessness response plan, as to what and people actually at the city too as well, as to what exactly the city is supposed to do and what exactly the county is supposed to do under this plan. And it is really difficult to actually tell what each jurisdiction will take care of. With that said, the county has most of the money. The Joint Office of Homeless Services has $285 million in its 2025 fiscal year budget. The city contributes $31 million or so, but it also gets back about $20 million of that to help pay for some of the other services that the city provides. So the county takes care of most of the publicly funded shelter programs. Those shelters, they pay for those. A lot of their budget actually pays for, you know, to the different nonprofits and stuff that run those shelters. They do have the warehouse for the distribution of those tents and tarps, sort of harm reduction. You know, there's no City of Portland Health Department. That's a Multnomah County Health Department. Takes care of that. So even within the city limits here, it's Multnomah County Health Department that's taking care of that. And that would include things like harm reduction, you know, clean needle exchanges, things like that. But also, yeah, tents and tarps that reduce harm against people that are experiencing homelessness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're almost at the end of our conversation here. Very, very important topic. What are your any last thoughts that you think our listenership should really pay attention to in regards to this issue?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that came out of these discussions is this argument that it's based on a 2022 agreement that the city has with based on ADA violations, because John DeLorenzo, as the attorney and lobbyist who kind of opened this thing up, sued the city, said that people with disabilities can't get through the walkways. And that is true. I mean, that is a really difficult thing. The obvious solution for that would be to get people off of the sidewalks and tents and into housing. So there's a bit of a disingenuous argument happening there, because that conflict, I talked to Tom Stenson at Disability Rights Oregon, who's saying that this conflict amongst people with disabilities is kind of manufactured by people in power who are failing to address the root causes of homelessness, one of which is people with disabilities are very much excluded from housing.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
What we have to do is get back to a place where our values are what is driving the economy. This system can be reformed.
Although Indigenous people are responsible for a significant proportion of sustainable land stewardship across the planet, they're often overlooked and seldom invited to the table when policy decisions are made. This week on Sea Change Radio, we're pleased to welcome Indigenous economist Rebecca Adamson to discuss her pioneering work in the sustainable development space. We examine the